I'm Hannah Storm, and my new podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, chronicles my 6 decades in professional basketball, from growing up in the sport to becoming one of sports TV's first female broadcasters. Join me as I dig deep into the game's history, unearth some wild stories, and talk to my friends from the world of basketball, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley. It's been a wild ride, and now I get to take you with me. Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
A rested child is a happy child. Sleep Tight Stories is a weekly podcast that brings comfort and joy to families worldwide with calming bedtime stories. The stories are relevant to children and spark wonder without overstimulation, so they can fall asleep and stay asleep. Listen to Sleep Tight Stories on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. For a bedtime routine you'll miss when they're grown, Sleep Tight Stories.
More Than a Movie is back with Season 2. I'm your host, Alex Fumero. And each week, I'm going to talk to the people behind your favorite movies. From The Godfather, Andy Garcia.
He has the smarts of Vito, the temper of Sonny, the warmth of Fredo, and the coldness of Michael.
To the legend behind La Bamba, Lou Diamond Phillips.
When I walked in, I didn't think I had a shot at Richie because John Stamos's picture was already up on the wall.
Listen to More Than a Movie on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Invention, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Invention. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And today we're going to be embarking on a sort of second part of our saga of photographic history. We just did several parts talking about the camera obscura and then the invention of photography. And now we're moving on to the motion picture. And I wanted to start with a question that might be a stupid question, but it's something that I often think about when I go to the movies. And it's that when you go to the movies, you sit down to see a motion picture, the basic media that you're viewing is a succession of still images that are perceived by the brain as continuous visual motion and audio that accompanies it. And so that in itself is pretty neutral, right? Like that it could show you any number of sights and sounds, but what we came to view for some reason as the motion picture, the thing you go see in a theater, most of the time these days is something like a visual novel or a visual short story. It's like a story-shaped thing, and then you watch it for an hour and a half or 2 hours, and then it's over. And obviously, there are lots of exceptions to this. And if you want to expand to video, you know, I mean, God, I mean, there's a whole pool of different kinds of content out there. But the things we think of as movies are these stories, and I wonder why that is.
Well, I mean, there's a lot to be said about just the importance of storytelling in human culture, something we've talked about on Stuff to Blow Your Mind recently. I think that's a major factor. Like, what do we do with our art and our technology? Well, we do human things. We tell stories, for starters.
But it's interesting when you go back to the earliest days of the motion picture. I feel like you get a sense back then that it wasn't always necessarily going to be this way.
No, because, yeah, some of the examples we're going to discuss in this episode, you see the more the scientific direction of motion picture, the way that motion picture can be used to unravel what is actually going on in the world, to slow it down and to better understand it.
Yeah, to either present kind of a non-story-based visual spectacle, to just kind of show you a succession of things happening, or to study, to study the world and get a closer look at it, maybe to see it in a kind of slow motion that you wouldn't have seen before.
So you're wondering if there's perhaps like an alternate reality where, say, documentary is the primary, like when someone says, hey, do you want to come over to our house and watch a movie? You just assume documentary. And then if it's a fiction film, you're like, oh, it's not a documentary. How surprising.
Or things that might be called like art films now. I mean, there are a million different ways you could show somebody a succession of still images simulating motion and accompanying sound. And it would not, and like, you know, there's an infinite variety of things you could do there that wouldn't be a story that somewhat simulates the structure of a novel.
Yeah, or I mean, there are plenty of examples of things like, say, live sporting events.
Yeah,
are also presented via the medium of essentially the moving picture.
Yeah. Well, maybe then this just has more to do with our categories, like the things that we end up calling movies.
Right.
Because as you know, as we mentioned a minute ago, there's a whole internet full of video content that you wouldn't call movies, but it's something.
Right. Yeah. This does get to the heart of what we're talking about here and what we've been talking about with the evolution of photographic technology, how we see the technology grow, advance, then spread out and become, not merely the technology of elite individuals, but the technology of the masses, and then how that inevitably changes everything as well.
Exactly. Now, one of the things that we have been talking about in our history of photography here is how the invention of photography was sort of part of a quest for ever-increasing realism in imagery, mm-hmm. right? That was something that Louis Daguerre was concerned with. He wanted to create more and more realistic paintings first, working on his panoramas and the diorama, like taking the art of painting to new heights of realism and simulating real scenes. And of course, the next step beyond that is directly just transferring the light reflected off of things onto a permanent record. But of course, as we were talking about, fixed images are also sort of a simulation because reality is never a fixed image.
Right. We see a fixed image and it kind of implies motion, right?
Yeah.
There's this wonderful blurring that kind of takes place in our imagination.
Yeah. Just think about the ways that people had to be put in the Iron Maiden in order to have their portrait taken in the earliest daguerreotypes because, you had an exposure of several minutes and you couldn't move your face. So how natural is that a representation of a person? So the real way to get at reality even more, to get even closer to the experience of just looking at the world, would be to record continuous imagery.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a particular type of a video portrait. I think probably a number of people have probably seen it utilized in the film Baraka that came out many years ago.
I haven't seen it.
Oh, you should. It's fabulous, beautiful cinematography. Mm-hmm. Scenes of life and tradition and ritual around the world. But they have these wonderful scenes where it's just an individual staring into the camera, and you're just kind of locking eyes with them, and it feels very intimate. It's it's essentially a motion portrait.
That is interesting. I wonder why that didn't catch on once we had photo and video technology as the new form of portrait. You had painted portraiture, then you had photo portraiture. Why not video portraiture? So up on the wall, there's grandpa there just on a continuous loop of about 10 minutes of looking into the camera.
Well, that's what they have in the Harry Potter world.
You're right.
In the Harry Potter world, there do not seem to really be any stationary photographs. All photographs are these motion portraits.
So they're ahead.
Yeah, they are ahead.
And we don't lack the technology. It's just that doesn't seem to be what people want when they're in their portraiture.
All right. So as we've been discussing, some of the predecessors to the motion picture are very much the photographic technologies we've discussed before. Mm-hmm. But some things are not really directly related to that technology. And then we also really need to discuss some key phenomena that play into the experience of motion picture viewing.
Right. These would be neurological and brain phenomena, psychological right. phenomena also. And one of these phenomena has historically been referred to, though it's a problematic concept we can discuss a little bit, as persistence of vision. And other relevant phenomena that I think we'll have to mention are known as beta motion and the phi phenomenon, which we will collectively call apparent movement or apparent motion.
Right. So as we proceed, we'll kind of play catch up on all of that.
Yeah.
But let's start with this idea of persistence of vision.
Okay.
So how do we think about motion pictures? When it's really good, we often don't think about it at all, do we?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's what they say is the best director of a film is the one who creates a film where you don't notice the direction. Like you're not picking out technical elements. I mean, unless you're really looking for them. But it's the person who creates the film that is pure experience, right?
Yeah. You just get lost in the action, the emotion, the wonder. But even if we're, say, a little bit bored or checked out during a movie or a TV show, we may think of these things as we might just think of it as a massive production or a work of art. We might kind of take it apart in these different directions, right? Like, oh, I wonder how they shot this. Oh, this is This is a pretty long take. I'm bored, mm-hmm. but I'm admiring all the work that went into making it. But we're probably not thinking of the film that we're viewing as visual stimuli that exploits a loophole in the way that we process images.
Right, but that's exactly what it is. It's taking advantages of sort of particular facts about the way our eyes and our brains work to make us have the illusion that we're looking at continuous images when actually we're looking at a succession of still images that do not move at all.
That's right. So persistence of vision is the retention of a visual image for a short period of time after the removal of the stimulus that produced it. The human brain can only process 10 to 12 images per second, retaining an image for up to a 15th of a second. If a new image comes along within a 15th of a second, it creates an illusion of continuity.
Yeah. Now, in the 19th century, persistence of vision was originally sort of believed to occur because images lingered on the retina for a short period of time after you see them. But I think that's not exactly believed to be the true cause of the experience of persistence of vision now. It is true that fast successions of still images are processed in the brain as continuous motion as a single experience and not as a succession of images, but not because the retina functions like a camera taking snapshots that can be measured in frames per second where they stack up if they come fast enough. I think the idea there was that you'd sort of blend one frame into another that persists as new frames are sensed. But our modern understanding of vision as perception is less like a camera taking snapshots and more kind of like an integrated sensation that involves the brain as much as the eyes. So even though the original understanding of persistence of vision might not be exactly technically correct, I think it's still useful as a metaphor for one way that the still image seems to flow smoothly from one moment to the next if these still images are projected fast enough and it ultimately simulates continuous motion.
Yeah, and so motion pictures were traditionally 16 frames per second for silent films and then 24 frames per second for sound films.
And that seems to be kind of a low threshold
right, yeah.
of what is good enough for us to perceive as continuous motion.
Yeah, anything less than that, and you're going to get into sort of a herky-jerky stop-motion kind of feel.
Right. 'Twas then that the herky-jerky man came singing songs of love.
Yeah, the Phi effect was originally defined in 1912 by psychologist Max Wertheimer, and he looked at it as a type of optical illusion of perceiving a series of still images when viewed in rapid succession as a continuous motion.
Yeah, and this is one form of apparent movement. Unfortunately, it seems to me that these two concepts are apparently constantly confused in writings on photo history. I came across this because I was getting confused reading about them when preparing for the episode. So in writings on vision, perception, and film scholarship, the definitions of beta movement and Phi effect seem kind of blurred together. As documented in a 2000 paper published in the journal Vision Research. So it took me forever to figure out what was going on here, and I was glad to find out it wasn't just me. Now, here's the short, simple version. Both of these two phenomena, the Phi effect and beta movement, they enable us to see various kinds of illusory motion in successive still images, but they refer to different speeds of projection and types of visual sensation. And to the best of my understanding, it appears to me that what's taking place in our perception of films is more related to what's known as beta movement. But either way, it's the brain's tendency to interpret certain types of changes in successive static images displayed at the right speed as smooth continuous motion. So, for example, if you see successive still images in which three dots are changing position on a black background in between the images, if you project them fast enough, we don't see images one at a time, but we see a snake moving around.
Right. Basically, you know, what happens when you make a little flip book out of the corners of a document.
Yeah. So on its own, apparent movement is an extremely interesting phenomenon given what it illustrates about the brain. It might be more mysterious and more interesting than we give it credit for, especially now that we're used to the idea of movies. But we've discussed it a bit on Stuff to Blow Your Mind before in the context of forming a perception of the present moment in our sense of now. Like apparent movement cited under the name of the Phi effect can be demonstrated, for example, by rapidly flashing dots on different parts parts of a screen. And if the flashes are timed and positioned correctly, we don't just perceive a dot flashing here and then a dot flashing there, but we perceive a single dot that moves between the locations of the flashes. And this is one of the many, many ways for us to realize that our vision is not a straightforward, objective record of reality, but it's a world of sensations stitched together in the brain based on objective light data, but definitely not a one-to-one representation of it. And just as a side note, because it's too strange and interesting not to mention, one really spooky effect here is the so-called colorify effect. So what happens if you take this principle of two flashing dots perceived as a single dot in motion and then you change the colors of the dots between flashes? If your brain perceived continuous motion when there was none, how does it handle the color change between the endpoints of this path you imagine you see the dot taking, right? Flashes here, then flashes there, but changes color in between. What does the brain do there? Well, studies show that people tend to perceive a change in the color of the dot about halfway along the path that it takes. So you flash a red dot, then you flash a green dot, and people see a dot zip from one place to the other and change color from red to green about halfway there. But the really interesting question is, how can you have seen the dot change color halfway there if it wasn't actually traveling and you didn't know what color the second dot would be until you saw it?
Oh, wow. Yeah, that really forces you to rethink how we're perceiving now, how we're perceiving time.
Exactly. It's so strange because it's like for a split second, your brain was able to predict the future. But of course, we know that's not what happened. In fact, what this seems to indicate instead is that not only is our vision a stitched-together impression in our minds that's not a one-for-one representation of reality, our perception of time from moment to moment is a stitched-together simulation as well, such that, like, our very perception can essentially be post-dicted. What you think you see in one split second can be changed by what you see a split second later. It's not until after you see the green dot that your brain forms your perception of the dot you saw halfway along its imaginary journey. So this means you're not just seeing with your eyes, you're seeing with your memory and with other cognitive functions of your brain. So it's vision is not reality, of course. It's an illusion mostly informed by reality. But it's sort of formed in an antechamber of consciousness that's not quite there in your sensation, where things are quickly edited together for you to perceive. And of course, all this is crucial in the way that movies work. Movies are not merely audiovisual objects. They require quirks of the human brain to make sense and to feel like representations of reality.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to continue to discuss how the motion picture works in our brain and then also some of the earlier models of this technology.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, digs deep into the history of professional basketball, along with my own as one of the first female sportscasters.
Now let's get you up to speed on what else happened around the NBA today.
We talked to all sorts of people I interacted with, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley, and recap iconic moments.
Yes, he's got it. Here he comes. Ray rock the baby to sleep and slam dunk.
As well as some of the wild stories behind the scenes.
We were like, what? What are we in for? The scoreboard crashes before we even tip a game off.
Today, the NBA is a global sports and entertainment giant. Players are multimillionaires and cultural icons.
Iguodala to Curry, back to Iguodala, up for the layup. Oh, blocked by James. LeBron James.
And these stories are about how we got here, both on and off the court. And what's next? Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
When your child fights sleep, it can feel like a battle you'll never win. Imagine a bedtime routine you all look forward to, where you cuddle in and let the stress of the day melt away. Welcome to Sleep Tight Stories, a calming weekly podcast that brings bedtime stories, cuddles, and comfort to families worldwide. The stories are quirky, relatable, and spark wonder without overstimulation, so listeners can fall asleep and stay asleep. Each episode is narrated by me, Cheryl McLeod, a second grade teacher, and written by my husband, Clark, an eternal second grader at heart. Tune in tonight and bond over a story before drifting off to sleep. Make bedtime the sweetest part of your day. Sleep tight stories. Listen to Sleep Tight Stories on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
More Than a Movie is back with season two of the award-winning film podcast, and this time with a lot more movies. I'm your host, Alex Fumero, and each week I'm going to talk to the people behind some of my favorite movies. From The Godfather, Andy Garcia.
He has the smarts of Vito, the temper of Sonny, the warmth of Fredo, and the coldness of Michael.
To the OG spy kid, Alexa Penavega.
You had Carlo Gugino, who's the coolest mom ever. You had Antonio, who's handsome, amazing, charismatic. And then Carmen and Juni. I felt like a lot of other kids felt like this could be me.
To the legend behind La Bamba, Lou Diamond Phillips.
When I walked in, I didn't think I had a shot at Richie because John Stamos's picture was already up on the wall.
Every episode will feature interviews with the biggest actors, directors, writers, and producers behind your favorite films and tap into the history of Latinos in film. Listen to More Than a Movie as part of the My Cultura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, so I've got a kind of weird proposition about film technology.
Okay.
And it is that film technology, we should think of the earliest versions of it that originally evolved as a specifically human biotechnology, sort of like a medicine made specifically for the human body rather than as a pure physical technology, because it has to do specifically with the human brain and the human eye.
That's right. This is something that I think is really mind-blowing to think about, because given the numbers we mentioned previously, you know, the human brain can only process 10 to 12 images per second, and then the way the image will persist for the 15th of a second, you might be thinking, well, what about animals? What about the various pets that we sometimes have hanging out in our living rooms while the TV is on?
Mm-hmm.
You might wonder, well, can some animals not see television or films?
Or at least not see it the same way we do.
Right. And then how do they see it? What would that be like just to have different eyes, different visual processing? Well, I was wondering about this, and I found an excellent little article in Science Nordic. And in this particular article, Do Dogs See What's Happening on TV? They talked to Otto Ropstad, an associate, or at least then associate professor at the Norwegian School of Veterinary Science. And he pointed out that this would probably be like a strobe light torture show for various animals to try and watch or be forced to watch television or a movie, at least on an older television set.
So they're being visited by the herky jerky man,
basically. So the article points out that while humans require, in this article it said 16 to 20 images a second to perceive the illusion of films, dogs require 70 images per second. So it's really only been in the past decade or so that TV has become watchable to the canine audience. So at least for the vast majority of canines out there.
Yeah, my dog has never shown any interest in TV at all, even our more recent TV. But I think that may just be because he's a snob. Because I was looking this up, and there is research indicating that dogs can recognize images such as the images of other dogs and humans on modern digital TV screens. It just seems like some dogs don't really care.
Hmm. I also wonder about just like the senses and that are important to a given organism.
Yeah.
Because obviously,
if a dog can't smell.
Yeah, the dog's sense of smell is phenomenal. Like they live in a different sensory realm that it's really difficult for us to try to even imagine. Where it's really like odor first, and if you remove odor from the equation, they're just not going to be taken in by the illusion. But we put all of our emphasis on visuals, and then and audio second. And we don't, for the most part, we don't really care what a film would smell like,
right?
outside of a few smell-o-vision gimmicks here and there. For the most part, we're fine not smelling the film.
Are we going to do an episode on smell-o-vision, one of the most important inventions of the 20th century?
I think it would be cool to do an episode where we talk about all the sort of failed inventions and innovations of the movie theater industry.
Uh-huh.
Getting into the Tingler and whatnot.
The Tingler.
Yes. fun film, The Tinkler. Dogs, 70 images per second. The article points out that birds need 100 frames per second to see. And while the article didn't mention cats, I have read elsewhere that they need 100 frames per second as well. And I have noticed that our cat, she will a lot of times just not look at the television, but occasionally we'll put on these HD bird watching videos on YouTube,
mm-hmm.
and she definitely perks up and gets into those.
Oh, really?
Now, part of that is listening, of course. Cats have amazing hearing, so they are she's definitely listening to all these bird sounds, but then she's also tracking the movements as well. But conceivably, though, this would not have been the case if you were playing bird videos in prior decades.
Well, I think one thing we should keep in mind is that while we can be fooled in this illusion of successive still images being interpreted as motion in our vision, that all our different senses are not all synchronized in how they perceive things.
Right.
And they don't get fooled in exactly the same ways. For example, I was reading somewhere that in the early days of film technology, when you would have like a hand crank film playback,
uh-huh.
people could deal with slight variations in the speed at which the visual frames were coming, but they could not deal with variations in which the accompanying sound was coming.
Yeah, I think back on the like the varying levels of video quality I've been willing to deal with,
mm-hmm.
such as watching like half scrambled episodes of Tales from the Crypt, in my childhood.
Yeah.
But when it comes to audio, if there is audio present, like you need it to have a certain degree of fidelity. Now, all of this that we've discussed, then, as you can probably guess, there are ways to get to these effects, to exploit these phenomena in the human visual processing system without using motion picture technology.
Right, photographic motion picture technology, right. Because I guess you could have different definitions of what motion pictures are, but like you could – there were things that were sort of like a movie before there was ever a photography-based movie.
Right. So the first thing we want to talk about here is just sequential images and sequential art. And we could easily do an entire episode on sequential art. For instance, I highly recommend Understanding Comics by Scott McCloud. If you're at all interested in comics and you haven't picked this up, you definitely should. It's an insightful, comics-based breakdown of all of this. So it itself is in comic book form, and it discusses like how comics work, how they're composed, and its origins in sequential art.
Can I admit a weird personal thing about my experience with comics? And I don't know why I do this.
Mm-hmm.
Often when I read a graphic novel or read a comic book, I find that I have to go back several pages and look at the pictures because I get into a rhythm of just reading the text in each frame and only barely noticing what the imagery is.
Yeah.
And I find I have missed important plot elements because they were subtle visual things in the images.
Huh.
And I it's like I don't pay enough attention to that. And if I don't make myself, I don't do it.
Now, that's interesting. I've never experienced quite the same thing, but I do find myself, especially if I'm reading a book that's particularly gorgeous,
mm-hmm.
I have to remind myself to go back and look at the images just to take them in fully.
Yeah.
Because I'm just kind of speeding through them, and I'm not really focusing on all the work that went into each frame.
Yeah.
Which if you're dealing with some of the more gorgeous graphic novels out there, I feel like I'm doing a disservice to the book and also not getting my money's worth out of it.
Right. Yeah. You know? No, I feel that sometimes too, and I don't know why I have that tendency. I mean, it would seem almost obvious and automatic that you should pay attention to the images, but
yeah.
Sometimes the brain just doesn't work that way. Maybe this book you mentioned would help.
Yeah, I think it's a wonderful breakdown of comics, and it makes you appreciate them all the more. But it does get a little bit into the history of sequential images, sequential art. We should probably just summarize a bit and point out that the modern comic book, like what you're probably thinking of as a comic book, and our idea of comics itself, largely this came out of the 19th and 20th centuries. So some of the earlier forms actually predate the motion picture, such as the French comics of the 1830s.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you're going further back than that, when you're asking yourself, well, what are the oldest examples of sequential art.
I think about the fart scrolls.
The fart scrolls? Oh, yes, the Japanese fart scrolls.
Medieval Japanese fart scrolls. Yeah. I guess they're not necessarily always sequential, but...
But that is one of the areas you can end up going is not so much the fart scrolls themselves, but but the use of scrolls in Eastern traditions.
Yeah, like illustrated scrolls.
Yeah, scroll paintings in India, scroll paintings in East Asia and Chinese traditions. There are also some traditions in which the scroll is presented almost like a scrolling picture, mm-hmm. where it is there's a performance art to it as well. It's not just hey, look at these scrolls. It's like gather round, we will present to you the scroll.
Hmm.
And these are epic paintings where you just scan your eyes across you take it all in.
So this doesn't, in any kind of optical illusion sense, simulate motion, but it does allow you to cognitively put the motion together in your head.
Right, yeah. But then again, that does get kind of difficult too, right? Because we are creatures of the motion picture era, mm-hmm. making sense of sequential art and potential examples of sequential art from the past. So there are a lot of these examples where it depends on who's arguing which side. For instance, looking at some of the ancient cave illustrations,
mm-hmm.
some make the argument that, well, we're looking at some form of sequential art. Others say absolutely not. The Bayeux tapestry is another example where some make the argument that, yeah, what you're looking at here is sequential art, grisly medieval sequential art.
Uh-huh.
But again, in all of this, there is no actual illusion of movement.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was just thinking that on one hand, it makes sense to just naturally sort something like an illustrated scroll or a comic book into a different category than a modern motion picture with a high frame rate.
Right.
Because one, at least it seems to me, we just automatically perceive as continuous motion through this optical illusion, like the beta movement type things. And that's just automatic and immediate. And whereas this other type of thing, like a scroll or a comic book with successive images, requires cognitive effort and the imagination to piece together into a visual narrative that seems continuous. I do assume that that's probably a difference that's hardwired into the brain, but I wonder what sort of role conditioning and sort of a culture of imagination plays there, that if you don't have things like movies,
mm-hmm.
if something like a comic book or a scroll with successive images could, through a sort of culture of imagination practice, feel more like a movie does to us, with like this kind of automatic conjuring of continuous visual sensation. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. Again, this is one of those areas where you can really work, kind of think yourself into a circle when you start trying to decipher how you are actually absorbing any particular form of media.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you're getting into you're reading an action scene in a book and you're picturing it in your head,
mm-hmm.
And then you're watching an action scene, you're reading an action scene on a comic book page. There's something similar going on, but with more visual data to inform what's happening in your mind.
I read a book a couple years ago called What We See When We Read.
Mm-hmm.
I think the author's name was Peter Mindelsund or something like that. But I thought it was a really interesting book. Basically, it was just a sort of artistically put together extension of this question of what do you actually picture in your head as you read a piece of fiction? How does the imagination work? Because we have this idea that, like, okay, when I read a book, I see the character, but it keeps asking all these probing questions about what exactly is it that you think you see? How do you see it? And it really makes you start to question the experience of your own imagination. It's almost like the imagination can start to feel like a second order illusion within your mind.
Yeah, and I feel like in my own experience, it's changed a lot over time. Like when I first started reading like full-blown novels when I was a kid, I went to great lengths to sort of cast it in my head and decided like what actors were playing what characters.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would like focus on a consistent casting throughout my reading of the book.
Uh-huh.
But for the most part, I got away from that as I got older. Now I'll only rarely do that, or if there's some sort of film adaptation of a book or something, perhaps that'll kind of infect my thinking along it. I also remember there was a time when if I watched anything animated and then went and read a book, I would end up seeing it animated.
Mm-hmm.
And it would always kind of discourage me from reading. I'm like, I'll read this tomorrow when the cartoons are out of my head.
Yeah.
But I don't really experience that anymore.
I wonder if, does the animation or the live action take precedence when you've seen both? Like, so you've seen live action and animation of The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings. Does one have precedence in your mind?
It's weird because this is a great example, because there was a time, like the first time I read The Lord of the Rings, I went to great pains to not think about the animation.
Right.
And then in rereading The Hobbit to my son, I kind of forced myself to, and I think by just distance, by having not seen them in a while, I was able to avoid like summoning just the images from the Peter Jackson films and hopefully kind of have something in between, something that would just kind of emerge more from my mind as opposed from these visual adaptations.
I guess there are some elements that are easier to dash than others, because I feel like I could read Lord of the Rings without picturing most of the stuff from the movies, except like Christopher Lee would be stuck there.
Yeah.
I couldn't have any Saruman but him.
Here's another example. The Name of the Rose by Umberto Eco. The first time I read it, in high school, I think, I was a big fan of the film adaptation, which I'd seen previously. So of course I pictured Brother William as being Sean Connery.
But that's not really how he's described in the
book.
In the book, they say he's extremely tall and thin with red hair, I believe.
Yeah. So when I reread it, and this was several years ago, but during that, I went to great pains to focus myself and not picture Sean Connery, but instead to picture something more along the lines of, say, Jeremy Brett or maybe Jeremy Irons, you know, someone who has actually played Sherlock Holmes or has, you know, something more in line with the feel of a Holmes character.
Okay, I feel like we've gotten really far afield.
Yeah.
I think it's my fault. We should get back to simulations of the of movement, simulations creating this illusion of continuous motion, I guess after just mere sequential art, when there started to be devices that could rapidly show us images that would more automatically simulate motion.
And one of the crazy things about these technologies we're going to discuss here is that they all emerge from the same time period. They're all products of the photographic era and products of the birth of the motion picture.
Well, yeah. I mean, this is a time when people were thinking about the science of imagery and vision, not just in the invention of the photograph. Now, remember, it was in the 1830s that Louis Daguerre and Henry Fox Talbot were inventing their photography methods, like the daguerreotype and the what would eventually become Talbot's calotype method. It was in 1839 that they both announced them.
So in 1832, that is when we see a little invention that was known as the phenakistoscope.
Yeah.
And so you may have seen one of these in a museum, or perhaps you own one yourself as a toy or a collectible. But it's a spinning cardboard disc attached vertically to a handle. And then positioned radially around the center, the disc's center, you have a sequence of images that when rotated and viewed through slits on an opposing disc, this creates the illusion of movement, like a very simple animation. Generally, it's something like an individual jumping rope or an animal running, that sort of thing, a person walking. Another example of this, pretty much the same device, is the zoetrope from 1834, a cylindrical variation of the previous invention with viewing slits on the side. So it looks like a drum, and you rotate it and you stare through, and again, you watch a very simple animation unfold.
Yeah.
And these two, you'll find them in a lot of like hands-on science museums around the world.
Yeah, and to be clear, again, in the zoetrope, it's still images, but because you view them spinning rapidly and because you view them in these slices through the slits, it simulates the continuous motion. But it doesn't perfectly simulate it. It's a little bit jerky. And one thing that's cool about that is that it creates a kind of creepy effect. I was going to mention that there are several scenes with a zoetrope in the horror movie The Conjuring 2.
Oh, where, this is one with Patrick Wilson.
Well, he's in all the Conjurings, I think. He's in at least the first two. Okay. The second one's the one where he sings an Elvis song for somebody thought that was a good idea. But there's a scene where Patrick Wilson stares into one of these zoetropes. He's looking through the slits as the thing is spinning, and he watches this strange man in a bowler hat and an umbrella walking around until suddenly, like, there's a jump scare. A boogeyman with bad teeth does a jump scare on Patrick Wilson. But it's actually a very effective sort of set piece object for a horror film, because there is a way in which its obvious and not quite there simulation of smooth motion is unsettling. Mm. I can't think if I've seen it used in another horror movie. Maybe it has been. But certainly other films have used the idea, if not of a zoetrope, at least of a flickering presence or gait, like I think of The Ghost in the Ring.
Yeah.
Basically, I think any presence that is almost but not quite smooth and continuous the way modern films are tends to be perceived, at least these days, as creepy or horrifying. And this could have to do with a version of the Uncanny Valley effect, which we've discussed on a couple of episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind. But it's clear that a lot of people perceive that type of motion or presence in a flickering way as creepy today.
Well, I know with Samara in The Ring, if I remember correctly, they filmed the actor walking backwards and then reversed the footage.
Yeah.
So she's walking towards the camera, but the motion, like we can tell there's something weird about the motion, the way that her limbs are moving.
Yeah, but there is also like a flicker, like there's a glitch in a VHS tape or something. And so that's a weird – so there's the weird gait and there's the flickering like you would see in the zoetrope. I don't know if it would have been perceived as creepy in the same way back when these things were popular children's toys. Maybe, maybe not. I don't know.
Huh. Now, another case, and this is a really fun case to consider, is the flip book.
Okay.
And, you know, it's easy, especially with hindsight, to assume that the flip book was surely invented, you know, well before these previous advancements. But there's no evidence that it was.
Really? I mean, I made them when I was a kid. You have to imagine that people came up with this idea hundreds of years ago.
Yeah. I mean, I would guess like, well, all right, well, you need paper, so you'd need the printed word, and then you would just need somebody bored enough to start drawing like a cartoon horse in the corner and then flip through them to create the illusion of movement. You know, the kind of thing that we all did as children in various notebooks and what have you. But when you start looking at the history, it looks like, again, this is one of those things that, yes, it clearly could have been invented at any point. As long as that we had paper and it was readily available, you had some sort of flippable book at your disposal. But it seems like 1868 is about as far back as we can go with the flip book. That is when British printer John Barnes Linnet patented a flip book, and that's the oldest known documentation of the flip book. And I think a few things are illuminated here. As we've discussed in previous episodes, the dangers of hindsight in considering the history of inventions.
Right.
Also, just the true impact of motion picture technology and the way it's changed the way we think about images. And then, of course, the fact that for most of history, paper wasn't something so readily wasted, or even bound flippable books, I imagine, were too revered for someone to make a bunch of scribbles in the corners.
Right. Though I'm kind of surprised a monk never made one in the Middle Ages, like doing an illuminated manuscript.
Well, it's entirely possible that it did and it didn't survive. Like, that's possible. There's just no evidence.
Yeah.
I think there have been some cases for certainly sequential art in illuminated manuscripts, but not a flip book, nothing that creates the actual illusion of movement.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
Hindsight bias.
Exactly.
All right, I think we need to take another break, but then we will be back to discuss a little more about the technology that directly preceded the motion picture.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, digs deep into the history of professional basketball, along with my own as one of the first female sportscasters.
Now let's get you up to speed on what else happened around the NBA today.
We talked to all sorts of people I interacted with, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley, and recap iconic moments.
Yes, he's got it. Here he comes. Ray rocked the baby to sleep and slam dunk.
As well as some of the wild stories behind the scenes.
We were like, what? What are we in for? The scoreboard crashes before we even tip a game off.
Today, the NBA is a global sports and entertainment giant. Players are multimillionaires and cultural icons.
Iguodala to Curry, back to Iguodala, up for the layup. Oh, blocked by James! LeBron James!
And these stories are about how we got here, both on and off the court. And what's next? Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storr on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
More Than a Movie is back with season two of the award-winning film podcast, and this time with a lot more movies. I'm your host, Alex Fumero, and each week I'm going to talk to the people behind some of my favorite movies. From The Godfather, Andy Garcia.
He has the smarts of Vito, the temper of Sonny, the warmth of Fredo, and the coldness of Michael.
To the OG spy kid, Alexa Penavega.
You had Carlo Gugino, who's the coolest mom ever. You had Antonio, who's handsome, amazing, charismatic. And then Carmen and Junie. I felt like a lot of other kids felt like this could be me.
To the legend behind La Bamba, Lou Diamond Phillips.
When I walked in, I didn't think I had a shot at Richie because John Stamos's picture was already up on the wall.
Every episode will feature interviews with the biggest actors, directors, writers, and producers behind your favorite films and tap into the history of Latinos in film. Listen to More Than a Movie as part of the My Cultura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parents, ready to discover a new educational and interactive podcast for kids? Join Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids, where episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We learned how to recycle at the beach.
That was great fun. Cowie, what do you say?
It was. And that time when we did the science experiment and Billy made raisins dance.
That is so cool, Billy.
He did. Not to mention when a certain Elliot took up swimming classes with Lisa.
That was me.
Bet you can't catch me.
I'm going to get you.
All this fun and more in our Stories for Kids. Lingo Kids Stories for Kids is now available on Storybutton, the kid-friendly device for screenless podcast listening. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back.
So when you think about a motion picture camera, in order to do what it does, it has to take a lot of photos in very quick succession that can be played back in very quick succession, right? In order to get the level of frame rate that actually looks like motion to our eyes. So how do we get there? Like, what was there between the daguerreotype or the calotype, you know, these single exposure camera shots and the actual movie camera?
Yeah, I can't help but use the metaphor of guns and weapons of war when thinking about it, because certainly a daguerreotype would be kind of like an old-timey cannon, right?
Uh-huh.
It was a pain to load it, to aim it, to fire it, and then you'd have to go through the whole rigmarole of loading it again.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you were dealing with lengthy exposure times in some of the earliest cameras, right? But for a motion picture camera to function as a motion picture camera, you essentially have to have a machine gun.
Yeah.
It's just taking picture after picture after picture after picture.
And so one thing that immediately occurs to me is that you've got to somehow deal with a change in the media on which it's recorded, because the earliest photos were taken on media that had to be sort of specially prepared and loaded up one at a time. How could you load a camera for rapid exposures of many images?
Yeah, and when we're talking rapid exposure, we're talking exposure times of a fraction of a second. A long way from those hour-long exposures that we were talking about in previous episodes for photography. By 1870, the exposure time was down to 1/100th of a second and ultimately 1/1000th of a thousandth of a second.
Which is fast enough for motion pictures, of course.
Right.
But how do you get all the, like, obviously you're not going to be using, like, metal plates for that.
Right, yeah. Well, so here's the thing. One of the earlier approaches to this problem simply involved using multiple cameras.
Ah.
Like, you know, think again about the Canon. Well, you can't possibly create a single old-timey Canon that's going to fire six cannonballs in the space of a few seconds. It's impossible.
Get you six cannons.
You get six cannons, you line them up, you have them, you know, in the ship, right?
Uh-huh.
And then you just fire them all off in succession. That's exactly the approach that was taken early on by photographers such as Edward Muybridge.
Oh, yeah.
Famous for his running horse images from 1877. He used a battery of 12 cameras to pull this off.
And I guess we'll explain more about that in a minute.
Yes.
Now, before we came in here, Robert, you were telling me some strange details about the life of Edward Muybridge that I have never heard before.
Yeah, I was reading a little bit about him in The History of Photography by Beaumont Newhall. And Muybridge is a fascinating character.
Do you know why he spells his name the way he does?
Yes. So he wanted his name to sound more archaic because he was born Edward James Muggeridge, and he wanted a fancier show name, essentially.
So it's Edward in his name is spelled like Ed Weird.
Yes. And then Muybridge is spelled Muybridge.
Okay.
So earlier in his life, he was born in 1830. He would die in 1904. But earlier in his life, he was a bookseller. But then he sustained severe cranial injuries in a runaway stagecoach crash in 1860.
Okay.
Which it was a brutal accident. Actually killed one of the passengers and injured just about everybody else too. But anyway, you know, severe cranial injuries required a good year of treatment. And he was forever changed by it. Possibly, this is possibly the reason for some of his emotional and erratic behavior later in life. But during his recovery, he took up photography.
Okay.
Now, photography is where he would really make his name.
Yeah.
But as a there was just a note about a murder trial that took place.
What?
In the history of photography. So I had to look into it a little bit more, and this is the story. Basically, in 1872, he married Flora Shallcross Stone, but then he caught wind of a former lover that lived in the area, a Major Harry Larkins, and he got it in his head that Larkins was the father of Stone's son, Floredo. So Muybridge went to Larkin's house, confronted him at the front door, and shot him dead on his doorstep.
Oh, no.
Yeah. He shot him, and then he died later that day. At any rate, fatally shot him on his doorstep. And so Muybridge was accused of the murder, and the defense ended up leaning on his previous brain injury, saying, look, you know, he was in this horrible accident, and it changed the way his brain works. And they brought in expert testimony. They brought in people to speak to say, yeah, he was a totally different person before this took place. And they were going for, an insanity plea, which I've read that Muybridge apparently undercut this himself when he was questioned. But at any rate, the judge ended up throwing out the insanity plea and then acquitted Muybridge on grounds of justifiable homicide.
I guess that was a different time.
Yeah, it was. Because there was no questioning based on what I was reading that he killed this guy.
Yeah.
He murdered this guy on his doorstep. But yeah, he was acquitted, and it was considered justifiable homicide. It was an important case apparently because it serves as like an historic forensic neurology case in neurology, forensic neurology, neurology defense. It would also, by the way, go on to become an opera. Philip Glass would compose an opera based on these events titled The Photographer.
Hmm.
But it's just a really tragic episode. Flora petitioned for divorce, had to do it twice, and was finally granted it. She died in 1875, and then Muybridge had the son placed in an orphanage, and Floredo ended up working his entire life as a ranch hand and a gardener, and he himself died in 1944 in a pedestrian traffic accident. But Muybridge had established himself by this point as a photographic pioneer. Former governor of California Leland Stanford had commissioned him to photograph his racehorses, work that was interrupted by the trial. But the resulting images were widely published for their detailed depictions of horse locomotion.
And this was the idea of using multiple cameras set up in succession to capture images very rapidly back to back.
Yeah, run the horse past this battery of cameras, fire the cameras off, and then we can look and see, are the horses legs actually all coming off the ground as it runs across the field.
Apparently, this is a controversy in the 1870s. Like, people are actually highly concerned to know whether the horse is ever completely airborne or always has at least one hoof on the ground.
Right. Yeah. And so these images were a sensation. They were widely published for their detailed depiction of horse locomotion. And in 1880, Muybridge invented what he called a zoogyroscope or a zoopraxiscope to project his pictures on the screen. So, you know, in all of this, from capturing locomotion to projecting images, he was highly influential. Like, he influenced a number of individuals who would go on to continue to tinker with and innovate motion picture technology.
I'd heard about his accomplishments in photography before, and I'd never heard about, like, the murder or any of this.
Yeah, it's a brutal and sad story because it's one of those where you're dealing again with a brain injury as well. So it's not just a situation. And I mean, we've talked a bit about this on Stuff to Blow Your Mind. When you really start breaking down like neurological realities, a lot of our judgments about people's behavior are not so cut and dry.
Yeah.
But this one I feels especially problematic. First of all, because of the brain injuries he sustained. And then secondly, because it's just like he clearly murdered somebody in cold blood and was acquitted.
Yeah.
So it's a tragic episode. But like I say, he influenced a number of individuals, including in the 1870s, French physiologist Etienne Jules Marais, who lived 1830 through 1904. Yes, the same years that Muybridge lived, and they both died in May of 1904, 1 week apart.
Okay.
So it's just pure dumb luck. But it's one of those things.
You're not suggesting Muybridge did it.
No, but it's one of those things when I was putting together my notes, I was like, oh, did I just write down the wrong dates for this individual's life? Because they are exactly the dates of the previous individual. No, they just happened to have been born and to have died in the exact same years. But anyway, Marais, he invented what he would call the chronophotographic gun to capture the movements of birds in flight. So he set out. He's one of these individuals who, like, he was really going after the science first. Like, he was he wanted to break down how a bird is flying, to capture the visual details that are happening too fast for the human eye to observe. And so he was developing the photographic technology to make it happen, inspired by Muybridge's work with horses. And this is a wonderful contraption to look up because it really did look like a gun. It imprinted 12 photos a second on a rotating glass plate. And it had like a butt, you know, for his shoulder. It had a trigger. Like it was built on the stock of a rifle. So there are these wonderful old illustrations of a gentleman, presumably Marais himself, going down on one knee and holding up this fabulous photographic gun and aiming it at birds in flight. And with this device, again, he's doing what Muybridge did, but he's doing it with a single instrument.
Yes, with one camera. Mm-hmm. So this is a step closer, actually, to the idea of a movie camera.
Right. Again, only 12 images here. So all he could do and all he was setting out to do, of course, was to capture the movements of a bird. And the images that this camera gun produced are pretty impressive. Like they are taking locomotion that is happening at a scale that the human eye can't really perceive and the human mind can't fully process. And it's breaking it down so that we can analyze it. And this continued to inspire, both of these cases continue to inspire other individuals to do the same thing with human locomotion, with the locomotion of various animals, really taking on the scientific task of using this new technology to better understand what is transpiring in reality.
Well, as we were talking about at the very beginning, it makes me imagine an alternate history in which movies come about, but they're only considered like a tool of documenting reality in order to study it, and they never get repurposed into like any form of storytelling.
Yeah, or you could imagine an alternate world where it's prohibited, where cinematic technology, photographic technology is only for science and truth, never for narrative.
Never for Transformers.
All right. Well, we're going to go ahead and cut this episode off here, but we will be back to finish with a part two on motion picture technology.
That's right. We'll get into a great Edison rivalry that doesn't even involve Nikola Tesla.
Yeah, but Edison will definitely play a role, as will Kodak, as we set up in previous episodes, and we'll discuss more about just the impact of like how motion pictures were initially perceived and how people reacted to this new medium, and again how it's just changed the way we understand reality and the passing of time and our own sense of self. In the meantime, if you want to check out more episodes of Invention, head on over to InventionShow.com. That's where you'll find all the episodes. If you want to discuss episodes of Invention, a really cool place to do it is to head on over to the old Facebook and look for the Facebook group The Stuff to Blow Your Mind discussion module. That's where folks talk about episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, which Joe and I also host, but also episodes of Invention are discussed there as well.
Big thanks to Scott Benjamin for research assistance with this episode and to our excellent audio producer, Tari Harrison. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback about this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@inventionpod.com.
Invention is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my new podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, chronicles my 6 decades in professional basketball, from growing up in the sport to becoming one of sports TV's first female broadcasters. Join me as I dig deep into the game's history, unearth some wild stories, and talk to my friends from the world of basketball, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley. It's been a wild ride, and now I get to take you with me. Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
More Than a Movie is back with Season 2. I'm your host, Alex Fumero. And each week, I'm going to talk to the people behind your favorite movies. From The Godfather, Andy Garcia.
He has the smarts of Vito, the temper of Sonny, the warmth of Fredo, and the coldness of Michael.
To the legend behind La Bamba, Lou Diamond Phillips.
When I walked in, I didn't think I had a shot at Richie because John Stamos's picture was already up on the wall.
Listen to More Than a Movie on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Discover a new educational and interactive podcast, Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids. Our episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We went shape hunting around the block, and we found spheres and cubes on the street.
That was great fun. Join Stories for Kids, the Lingo Kids podcast, inspiring you to learn while having fun. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.